faith. What do you think would be a good definition of faith? What does faith mean to you? Well, I guess we know it's to do with trust, don't we? With trust and confidence, with committing ourselves to something, someone we believe to be true. So would we need faith to believe these things, for example? What do you think? Do you need faith to believe that 2 + 2 = 4? I don't think so, because that's true by definition, or true analytically, if we're going to put it technically. But there's very little in life that is logically true that we can prove in that way. And I would suggest maybe only some areas of mathematics you can prove in that way. And most things that we believe to be true, we believe because there's good evidence for it. And that's really important in faith, isn't it? Evidence, or it should be. And I think there's another element to faith as well, rather than just belief, because faith is also committing yourself to that belief, isn't it? Trusting yourself to it. And as somebody who enjoys swimming, I rather like this quote: to have faith is to trust yourself to the water. Faith, when we have faith in someone or faith in something, it involves trust. And I don't know about you, but I have had people say to me, oh, I wish I had your faith. Has anyone else had someone say that to them? As if faith was something only religious believers had. But everyone exercises faith. Every time you take the advice of your doctor or your dentist or your physio, every time we get on a bus or a plane, every marriage, every friendship demonstrates faith, doesn't it? But the important thing is, what do we put our faith in, or who do we put our faith in? We sung some words involving faith this morning, haven't we? Saying that we trust you, God, are here today. We're going to trust in you. And maybe you wonder how somebody could have faith like that. And those of you who know your Bibles will know that we're exhorted many times to have faith in God. Jesus said, didn't he, that the tiniest amount of faith can have a huge impact. He healed those who came to him with faith and rebuked those who didn't have faith. In fact, we're told that it's only faith in Jesus that can make us right with God and bring us peace with God, whatever kind of terrible times we might be going through. And in today's reading, we had that quote, I hope you noticed, without faith, it's impossible to please God. Without faith, it's impossible to please God. And as Tony said, over the next few Sunday mornings, we're going to be looking a bit together at Hebrews 11, which is all about faith. So just a word or two about Hebrews. Do we know who wrote it? We don't know who wrote it. Traditionally, it was Paul, but we're not sure who the author was or even who they were writing to. But I think it would be useful for us in the next few weeks to bear in mind two things about this book, because it's obvious that both the writer and the people that Hebrews was written to had a really thorough knowledge of the Old Testament scriptures, especially the first 5 books of the Bible, the Torah. So maybe the letter was written to Jewish Christians. There are lots and lots of references to Old Testament events and people in the book of Hebrews, and chapter 11 is a great example of that. And maybe you noticed that quote at the end of chapter 10 that Chris read to us. That was a quote from the book of Habakkuk and included the words, "My righteous one will live by faith." And the author was saying to his listeners here, hold on in faith. You're going through a tough time, but God will bring about what he's promised. He'll do everything that he's promised. And that's the other thing we know about the people for whom Hebrews was written. They were going through some tough times, and some of them had even abandoned their faith in Jesus. So the writer of Hebrews wants them to hold on to their faith. Remember, he says, who Jesus is, how amazing he is, far superior to all the heroes of faith we're going to be looking at in the next few weeks. He wanted them to encourage them to hold on to their faith. So faith is completely vital in all of our lives. And I love this quote from Martin Luther, who described this kind of faith as a living, daring confidence in God's grace. So sure and certain that a man, a woman, could stake their life on it 1,000 times. Well, maybe, like the first people who heard or read Hebrews, some of us need a bit of encouragement this morning to keep going. Maybe you're going through some tough times. Maybe circumstances are testing your confidence in God's grace, testing your faith. So what does this faith that pleases God actually look like? Let's get down to it. What does it actually look like? We know it's a gift of God and that real faith will show in how I live. But how do I know if I've got it? What does faith in God look like? I've been quite interested in the topic of faith, and I did a course about 8 or 9 years ago, and I finished up with a dissertation. 14,000 words, all about faith and reason and the relationship between it. You'll be very pleased to know I'm not going to read that to you this morning, because I think it would certainly send you to sleep. But what the writer to the Hebrew does this morning is just so much more brilliant than that. The writer of the Hebrews in our passage today says, what does faith look like in action? What does it look like when people do it? That's the best way to see it, not reading 14,000 words in a dissertation. So as Tony said in Hebrews 11, and some of you will know the chapter well, we've got a selection of characters, some really surprising, to help us understand what this faith looks like. And we're going to be looking at these characters in the next few weeks. Sorry, rather a long introduction, but I hope our appetites are sort of whetted to find out more about what our faith should actually look like. Okay, character number one, we've got three to look at this morning. And we're going to think quite briefly about just one thing that each character can reveal to us about this faith that pleases God. So with Abel, and I'm sure lots of you might remember Abel in the Bible, but if not, we've got to go right back to the beginning. If you've got a Bible with you, right back to the beginning of Genesis, and in fact, the beginnings of everything. And you may remember that Abel was the second son of Adam and Eve. So if you've got a Bible with you, it's in Genesis chapter 4, which is the story of the very first family and the story of the very first murder. I expect lots of you will remember. I don't mean you were there at the time, but you remember hearing the story. And younger son Abel had that job of looking after the sheep. While you may remember his brother Cain, the older brother, he worked the land. He worked on the soil, grew crops. And we read in Genesis 4, the Bible, that both brothers brought offerings to God. Cain brought some crops and Abel brought some meat. And we read that God approved Abel's sacrifice, but he did not approve Cain's sacrifice. And we're not told why. The Lord looked with favour on Abel and his offering, but on Cain and his offering, he did not look with favour. So Cain was very angry. He was very angry. So angry, you remember, that he killed his brother. For which, what have you done? God asked Cain. And he punishes him, sends him away. That's pretty much all we know about Abel. So why has the writer to the Hebrews put him in our list of heroes, heroines of faith? What are we meant to notice about him? He is referred to here in Hebrews as righteous. He's that in verse 4 of Hebrews 11. He's commended as a righteous man. And in fact, in one of the other very few references in Matthew, we read that Jesus commended Abel as righteous when he was sort of talking about a list of righteous people who'd been killed. He included Abel. So if Abel was to be counted as righteous, if he pleased God, he must have had faith. We know that, don't we? And I think as it is really the only thing we know about Abel, it must be to do with his sacrifice. Abel brought an offering to God. We don't know why he did that, he and his brother, whether God had commanded them to, or whether they had some kind of instinct that there was a holy God and they were sinful. I don't know, but obediently or instinctively, they brought their offerings to God. And if we go back to Genesis 4, it might just give us a little bit more of a clue as to what was different about Abel's offering. He didn't just bring meat. We're told he brought fat portions from some of the firstborn of his flock. He brought the best bits of what he had, some kind of offering back to God of what God had given to him, some kind of costly offering. And that's pretty much the first animal sacrifice we read about in the Bible. But we know there was a system of animal sacrifice that went on for hundreds of years. That was an acknowledgement that sin deserves some kind of penalty. And that was the way that people were approaching God. And of course, the readers of Hebrews have been brought up in that world. They knew all about animal sacrifice. In fact, in the chapters before chapter 11 in Hebrews, the writer talks quite a lot about it and says in chapter 9, without the shedding of blood, there is no forgiveness. But Hebrews makes it clear that system's all over now. Good, no more animal sacrifice. It was pointing to a new reality, which was the cross of Jesus. Chapters 9 and 10 of Hebrews, all about that, all about the cross of Jesus, this perfect sacrifice made once and for all, how the others were just a pointer to this sacrifice. And we read in chapter 12 that while Abel's sacrifice and even his own death speaks to us something about righteousness, acceptance by God, the writer says the death of Jesus speaks a much greater word, a much better word. Okay, so there's no need for animal sacrifice now. So what are we learning from Abel? Well, I think his example demonstrates to us that a life of faith is a life of sacrifice. A life of faith that pleases God is a life of sacrifice. Abel's faith led him to bring the best of what he had, and God counted him for that as righteous. So as people of faith, we need to acknowledge that we belong to God and that we are his to command. And I think that's quite a challenge. Do we bring our best, the best of what I have, to God? Is that what I do? Do I begin my day with giving it to him? Giving him my time, my energy, my strength, the best parts of that? Or do I just give him the bits that I don't miss very much? I was reminded a bit here of the story of, do you remember Jesus in the temple when he watched the poor woman who was a widow just putting a couple of tiny coins into the offering box? And he commended that woman. He said, well, looks like she hasn't given much, but the point is she's given sacrificially. She's given of what she had. And those people chucking in £50 notes and things, actually some of them aren't even missing it. She was commended for giving sacrificially. So a challenge to us, do we trust God enough for that? Do we trust him enough to give him the best of what we have? Do we love him enough to do that? Do we love to offer him our praise and our worship? That's another offering we can give, isn't it? Is it a priority for us to join together with others as we are today and worship him together, even if the service leader didn't pick our favourite songs today? Do we love him so much that we want to offer him our praise, our thanksgiving, and the best of our very selves? So that's what I wanted to say about Abel. I think his example shows us that a life of faith that pleases God is a life that gives sacrificially to God and to others as he's commanded us. That trusts God enough to put what he wants above what I want. That trust that actually he will keep his promises to keep me safe. I don't have to rely on these other things that I'm holding on to for my security. So that's Abel. Let's move on to character number two. You may or may not remember was, anyone still awake? Enoch, very good, Enoch. Jumping on a few generations, still in the book of Genesis, and if there wasn't much said about Abel, there's even less about Enoch. He's mentioned 5 times in the Bible, I found, with a bit of research, and mostly in lists of descendants of Adam. But between the two testaments, some of you will know a bit about sort of apocryphal books that appear between the testaments, and there are some books accredited to Enoch, although I'm not quite sure how he'd written them so much later, but anyway. And those described him as a prophet and a visionary who had tours of heaven and hell and did things like that. And I mention that because there is one other reference in the New Testament, which is in the book of Jude, and Jude quotes from one of those books of Enoch, when he talks about Enoch as a prophet. Sorry. But the place to find him mentioned is really back in Genesis 5, which again is really just a list of Adam's descendants. So if you've got a Bible with you, Genesis 5 is the place to be. And we read in verse 18 that Enoch was the son of, does anyone know? Jared. I don't expect you to know that one, really. Enoch was the son of Jared. He had a son called Methuselah. And then the passage says, when Enoch lived 65 years, he became the father of Methuselah. And after he became the father of Methuselah, Enoch walked with God 300 years and had other sons and daughters. Altogether, Enoch lived 365 years. Enoch walked with God. Then he was no more because God took him away. And that fact that God took him away was mentioned in Hebrews 11, wasn't it? By faith, Enoch was taken from this life, that he didn't die. He was taken away. He didn't see death. Because, says Hebrews 11, he pleased God. He believed that God existed and he lived a life of faith that pleased God. And maybe to show his approval, I don't know, God took him away, which is another interesting discussion, but we won't get into that this morning. But I think the key thing for us to notice, because it popped out twice in that passage, did you notice it? He walked with God. He walked with God. So a life of faith, Enoch shows us, is just a life walked with God. So what does that mean? I know a lot of you enjoy walking. I was going to use an example of Tony and Val here, but I decided I wouldn't. You might know that Julian, I'll pick on him instead. You might know that my husband Julian is a keen walker. In fact, he walks most days on his own at quite a ridiculous kind of pace. When he walks past the park runners in the park, he's walking past the joggers at the back. And he goes for quite ridiculous distances as well. But when we walk together, usually he doesn't go at that pace. Usually he matches his pace because, as you may have noticed, my legs are quite a lot shorter than Julian's. Walking together, I think, means walking in the same direction at roughly the same speed, watching where the other person is going. And generally, a lot of good conversation when I walk with friends anyway. Enoch decided at some point in his life to walk with God. Seems to be after his son was born. And actually, I think that's quite common, that when big things happen in our lives, good and bad, that often draws us to think about walking with God. Enoch believed that God existed and he chose to walk with him. In other words, he was walking in the same direction with God. So what does that mean for us? Walking God's way, walking with him, listening to him. For us, as we pray, talk to him, listen to him, read his word in our Bibles. Walking in the same direction, taking his guidance and trusting him for what's ahead, because we don't know what's ahead, do we? But he does. We all walk through life, don't we? And unlike Enoch, it's generally to be expected that we're going to walk through death as well. And we've sung a bit about that this morning, haven't we? Walking through the valley of the shadow of death, unless Jesus returns before then. And in that walk, faith for us means trusting, like Enoch, that what God has promised will happen. That even when we walk through the valley of the shadow of death, he's still going to be walking with us. What a difference that makes. He's promised he'll never leave us. And that he's promised us a future, a wonderful future ahead. So faith is trusting that, trusting him, trusting that we will be with him forever, because he said that nothing and nobody can separate us from his love. His rod and his staff, they comfort me. Walking with God. So should we come to our last example, who is Noah? Jumping on a couple of generations again in the book of Genesis. And I'm guessing everyone here probably knows a bit more about Noah. We can read all about him in Genesis chapter 6 to 9. You remember he lived at a time of violence and disregard for God's laws in the world. That's what we read. But like Enoch, we're told Noah walked with God. So he was counted by God as righteous. And God told him, I'm going to sweep all this evil away. I'm going to get rid of it. A great flood is going to come. And you remember God commanded Noah. Julian begged me to show a clip here from Evan Almighty, if some of you know the film, but I don't think we've got time. God commanded Noah to build a boat, a great ark, to preserve his life, his family's life, and the life of the animals and birds. And they were going to survive the flood, and there would be a new agreement between God and people established through Noah. And we can see that he's a great example of faith, and that faith means obedience. Noah acted in obedience to God through faith. And what an obedience that must have been when you think about it. I know it's a familiar story, but think about it for a moment. I mean, had Noah ever seen a flood before? Let alone a flood that was going to cover the earth and wipe everything away. To build this huge boat, remember he was given all the dimensions, and fill it with all these animals. What made him take that information seriously? This must have sounded crazy. Well, we know what it was. It was his faith. We're told he had a holy fear of God. In other words, he believed that God was God. Like God is God. God is able to do what seems impossible to us, what seems crazy to us. If God has promised it, it will come about. And that's what Noah promised. That's what Noah believed. And that's why he acted in obedience to God's command, even though everyone else must have thought he was a bit mad. Trust, putting his trust into that belief. He acted on it, didn't he? And that's why he's commended. Now, we know that Noah wasn't a perfect man, because we know a bit more about him from the book of Hebrews. And I'm guessing Abel and Enoch weren't perfect men either. I think that's encouraging it. But because of their faith, they were counted as righteous. Come on, let's come back to us again then. And let that example challenge us once more. Do we really put our trust in God enough to obey what he says, to do what he says is right? When the situation might look humanly impossible, when we don't understand all the reasons for God's command, do we trust him enough still to do what is right? Are we ready, like Noah, to bank our lives on the fact that God is God, and that God is good, that God is who he says he is, that God knows what is best for us? Faith isn't proof, is it? We said that at the beginning. We need faith because we can't see God, and life is often quite ambiguous. It seems to point in different directions. And if that weren't the case, we wouldn't need faith, would we? Faith is not contrary to reason, but faith can take us much further than our own human flawed reason. And remember, we've got so many more reasons to trust that God is who he says he is than these characters that we've looked at this morning. They didn't have very much to go on, did they, as far as we know? We know much more about what God has said and done through human history, and ultimately how he stepped into our world. How Jesus in his life and death became that one perfect sacrifice to enable us to be right with the holy God and to be forgiven. So while in a sense that faith of Abel, Enoch and Noah sort of pointed forward to that cross of Jesus, we're in a sense looking back, aren't we, to the cross as the culmination, that guarantee of all that God has ever promised to his people. I'm not sure if I'm keeping up with my slides or not. And sometimes life can seem confusing, unfair. Sometimes even God can seem unfair to us, I think, as perhaps he did to Cain. Sometimes faith means having to live with uncertainties and leave them unresolved within God's mystery. Sometimes faith means having to do that because we don't understand everything, and we're not going to understand everything. But faith is offering what we have. Sometimes, as with Cain, it might be that God says, actually, no, that's not what I want you to do. And then we need to keep trusting him and take the chance to learn more about him. Cain didn't do that, did he? He wasn't blamed for his wrong sacrifice, but for his reaction. He didn't trust God. But we've seen this morning, I think, that the real essence of faith is committing ourselves to walk with God every day and trusting him, not just with today, but also with tomorrow. Do you remember Paul writing in 2 Corinthians that we walk by faith and not by sight? So let's learn from the life of Abel that the life of a faith is a life lived sacrificially, loving and trusting God enough to give him the best of what I have. And from Enoch, that living a life of faith doesn't require any special kind of knowledge or qualifications, but in essence, it's a life spent walking with God. That's what it is. In step with him and going his way and obeying him, as we've seen with Noah. And let's be encouraged by their examples. And not just their examples, but let's encourage each other. I'm very encouraged by many of your examples of faith. I see how some of you have kept walking with God, even in the most tremendously difficult times. I see how many of you have been obedient to him in difficult kinds of ways. And that's really encouraging to me. So let's go on encouraging each other, as well as looking back to these heroes of faith who fortunately didn't stop with Noah. We're not perfect yet, are we? And sometimes our faith is quite weak. But we can keep asking God to increase our faith. So I'd like to finish just with two more quotes from some modern heroes of faith. And the first one, bit of a shame Simon's not here this morning because I know it's one of his favourite examples. It's the writer Corrie ten Boom. He said, "Never be afraid to trust an unknown future to a known God." I don't know the future, but we do know God. And the second one is from Martin Luther King Jr. "Faith is taking the first step, even when you don't see the whole staircase." Trust and obey, for there's no other way to be happy in Jesus but to trust and obey.